blows out those hills.
Well, it's 6 o'clock in the Greater Bay Area, and as the woman said, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills, and this is Thoughtline, where each week we try to tell you fun things, interesting things, things you need to know. Tonight will be no exception. We're going to talk about a new book called Where Monsters Walked, California Locations of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, 1925 to 1965. And we have the authors on the phone with us tonight. We have Gail and Ray Orwig. Good evening. How are you guys?
We're great.
That's great. So Where Monsters Walked, California Locations of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films. So how did this book come about?
We've always been big fans of, you know, science fiction, fantasy, and horror. I remember seeing The Time Machine when I was about 6 or 8 years old, and Gail seeing, you know, Dracula as a kid, and so we've always kind of collected on it. And one of the things that just kind of was an offshoot of collecting and watching all these films was we just thought it'd be kind of fun to see where some of these were. And back in '84, we went to visit an old college friend of Gail's, and we decided to go up into Hollywood and take a look at the location, one of the locations where they filmed Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And so I stood at the top of the hill, and Gail ran up from the Beechwood Market up the hill, and we took a picture just like they did in the film. And that went in a scrapbook. And so for the longest time, it was just, you know, go find locations and put them in scrapbooks and share them with friends. So it just kind of, you know, kind of like the snowball going downhill. It kind of evolved from that.
Yeah, and then after that, we were also asked to lend some of our photographs to different magazine articles to the fellow that wrote our foreword, which was Bob Stevens. And then he came up with the idea, geez, maybe you guys could write some of the articles for the magazines too. And then later on it was, gee, maybe we could do a book.
So 1957 was a really important year, because that was the year that Universal Studios released a package of 52 classic films that were made before 1948 to television for syndication, and they called it Shock Theater.
So
Shock Theater, also 1958, the next year was the year that Forrest J. Ackerman first started publishing Famous Monsters of Filmland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I take it that these were some important things that introduced you to classic horror films.
Oh. Yeah. In fact, I can even remember some of them when I was really, really young, like hiding behind a chair watching The Kronos when it started moving on the screen, and also Deadly Mantis, the sound that it made when it was flying. Those are some of my earliest memories. And then Forbidden Planet, when you can see the footprints going across in front of the before the ship, and then the voice going, "It's still coming." I could still remember that, and I was about 4 years old.
What are some of your favorite memories, Ray?
Oh, I remember being up at the Reno Air Races with my father, and theater across the street from our hotel was showing The Time Machine, and I was 6 or 8 years old at the time. And when I said, "Well, that looks like fun, Dad. Let's go see that." And so we went over there, and the Morlocks just scared the heck out of me. But it was great, though. I mean, I really I love the film. That and also seeing on one of those Channel 7 used to do a, I think it was Friday afternoon, science fiction movie TV back in the 60s. I remember the first time seeing Rocket Ship XM, which was very very dear to my heart. I remember that film and watching them speculate, you mean the whole planet's been destroyed by nuclear war? And, you know, as a little kid, you're going, wow, I mean, that's just amazing that something like that can happen. And that was one of the fun things when we started hunting down locations, was going and finding the locations where they shot Rocket Ship XM.
And where is the location for Rocket Ship XM?
Yeah, well, a little bit of Hollywood here. They have several locations that they filmed in Death Valley, up by Zabriskie Point, which is a very popular stop up there, and they're walking up and down the hill and across in front of where the little parking and observation lot is now. And so they walk across there, and then in the next scene, you see them walking through Red Rock Canyon State Park, which is miles away, and, you know, kind of the magic of Hollywood. You cut, intercut scenes together like
the
that.
The magic of movie making.
Yes, indeed.
Well,
Go
ahead, go ahead.
So that's being able to stand there. In fact, and there's a scene in Rocket Ship XM where they encounter this blind Martian woman, and so we have a video that we took of it. I had Gail sit down on the hillside exactly where this woman is, and I just pan across with the camera until I get to her, and I'm making up some narration about, as you can see, there's no life on this planet. Oh, wait a minute, maybe there is some life on this planet. And so we've had that's in the early scrapbook days when we were just making taking photos and making videos, you know, just for fun to show to friends after we came back from our trips.
Yeah, that's how we ended up having pictures of ourselves in the book, because to begin with, we took a lot of shots of ourselves standing where the monsters stood.
That's great. The name of the book is Where Monsters Walked, California Locations of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, and it covers a period from 1925 to 1965. Gail and Ray Orwig are on the phone, and they're the authors of the book. It's just come out on McFarland, McFarland Press, and you can ask for it at your favorite library. Request it there. They probably don't have it in stock yet. But Gail, you were a librarian, weren't you?
That's right. Yeah, I know that the library I used to work for has 4 copies on order.
Well, what tell us about, you know, because there's lots of really cool books that have come out about science fiction and horror and fantasy films. Was that your favorite section in the library?
Oh, yeah. I can even remember when I was in junior high, we went to the Newark Library because I lived in Newark, California, and we used to read all the books there. I had a friend that was in my junior high class in high school that was also a film buff, and so we read all the books on those subjects over there, and then her mother used to drive us over to the Fremont Main Library so we could read more of them.
Well, you know, that they're one of the things that's a challenge is that, of course, the Hollywood magic, movie magic, that they use multiple locations for films, so it's not like everything happens in one place. That's right.
That's right.
Absolutely. Yeah. You'll go in a door and it's one location. When they come out the other side of the building, it's, you know, something completely on the other side of town.
It's like, wow, they got over there in 5 minutes.
Yeah. The famous one is the War of the Colossal Beast, which was the semi sequel to Amazing Colossal Man. Is they have him confined in a hangar out at the L.A. airport. And he breaks loose, and later in the film, he's climbing the hill by the observatory at Griffith Park, which is clean on the other side of Los Angeles. And the joke about the film is always, well, you know, people must not be very observant that this colossal man got all the way across Los Angeles and nobody actually spotted him. So.
Just another day in L.A., probably.
Absolutely.
It very well be just another day in Los Angeles. That's just an amazing colossal man. No big deal. Yeah.
So that did in a way put some challenges to you to try to piece together where some of these places were.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There was there's a lot of, I don't know if you want to go into that, a lot of things. There's a lot of clues that you use to do this. The first thing is just, you know, being observant when you're watching the movie. I mean, you're looking at a movie and go, that building is kind of interesting, or look, there's some background hills that have a particular profile to them, or, you know, oh, was that a street sign those guys just drove by, or, you know, little things like that that, you know, can give you clues as to, you know, where that location might have been shot. You also have to notice, too, things that were clearly on a back lot, you know, a street that looks way too clean or just looks artificially dirty. You know, you're pretty sure, well, that looks like a back lot. Or if you saw it in five other films, you're pretty sure that was a back lot. So there's clues like that that we use. And
yeah, and another thing would be reading books that contain interviews with filmmakers, and when they talk about the films and they talk about where they were shot, and general location books. Like, there was a book out on just films that were shot at Catalina Island, and so that was useful for a couple of our Catalina Island films that are in the book. And then, in fact, the former is how we found out that Olvera Street stood in for Mexico and is actually, of course, in Los Angeles. And that was in the Cyclops, and that was in the Burt I. Gordon biography. And another great place, of course, to look is the Margaret Herrick Library in Beverly Hills, which is amazing. They have all kinds of reference books, and they have scripts. And if you're lucky, sometimes the scripts have notes on them as to where the sites were. I know we went through several of them and didn't make any hits, but one of the ones that we were looking for was called The Vampire, and we actually did find some notes in that one, even though some of the places don't exist anymore. We were happy to find a few of them, and we put those in the book.
Well, it is really surprising how many places are still around. I mean, you're talking about a period of films that were made between 1925 and 1965, mm-hmm. and that's a fur piece from where we are today. And even having some of this stuff still around is really pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's always really exciting to us to find some of the early films.
You know, when we found ones from the 30s, it's some of the things that you find. Well, Gail was mentioning the John Beale film, The Vampire. One of the other challenges, too, is when we take these location hunting trips, is you have a fixed amount of time, meaning you got to get back to the airport. And when we discovered the information at the Herrick Library for The Vampire, we had, what was it, 3 hours?
Yeah, 15 minutes.
You had 15 minutes to get into the Herrick Library, find this, and then we had maybe 2 hours before the plane was going to leave. So it's like, okay, do we have enough time to get to this location and still get back to the airport so we can make our flight? And so, or do we have to wait until the next time we take a trip? Well, that's kind of hard for people that are into this as much as we are. It's like, oh my God, we have to wait another 4 months or 5 months before coming down here again.
Yeah, because we actually had jobs.
Gail at the library, myself teaching school. And so, yeah, that's sometimes that's as big a challenge as actually finding the locations themselves.
Yeah, so the hunts always took place when we were on vacations.
So one of the things that you write in your book was finding the location for them.
Was the hardest
and most complicated bit of sleuthing that you had to do. Maybe you could tell us that story.
Yeah. Do you want to tell the story or shall? Okay. Anyway, so that being, you know, we knew that had to be an exterior location. Looking at it, they were clearly interacting with the background. And so, how to find this? Well, the first thing is the geology of it. You're looking at it, interesting the way the rocks look. And there was nothing that we could find other than, I think the press book said, the press book for the film said,
Was it 20 miles outside of Los Angeles?
No, outside of Palmdale. 20 miles outside of Palmdale, okay. But it didn't say what direction, north, south, east, west, where are we going? And so we had looked at a number of photos online, people's vacation pictures or desert pictures, or Palmdale actually had a film office. They hadn't a clue where this was shot, though, because it was way before the film office was ever established. And so we had taken two trips down there, gone all through the desert in different directions from Palmdale, found nothing. And so again, back to the internet again, and we're looking around. And one evening, I stumbled across a website, a gentleman named Blaney.
Yeah, Randall Blaney.
Randall Blaney, who had this ranch out in the desert. And then he rented out to advertising companies or film companies, television, that wanted to do work there. And he said the Blaney Ranch is a well-known location for the movie Them. Oh, almost passed out.
They fill our hearts.
And so I quickly, you know, called for Gail. We grabbed the telephone. We called this fellow up. And we said, would it be possible? This is what we're doing. We're movie location hunters. Could we come down and see your property? And he goes, absolutely. And he says, how about Memorial Day weekend? That was 2 weeks away. And so now we have to get tickets. We have to get down there. So we managed to do this. We said, yes, we'll do it. I figured whatever we had to do to get there. So we get there and meet him up at the ranch, and he takes us out on the property. And so we're looking around, and immediately we thought, oh, my gosh, the geology looks right. Everything looks right, except it doesn't match our photo.
Yeah, it didn't quite match up.
And so I think, you know, we brought him a T-shirt with the movie poster on it, and we were all excited. And so I think he might have figured that, you know, this wasn't quite right. And so, but he was very nice. He was so kind and helpful to us. And he, as we're leaving, he said, you know, you might want to drive over the hill, because on the other side of this hill, there's a little hotel gas station that they use for all kinds of filming. And
there were more rocks with the same kind of outcroppings.
Yeah, and so we drive over the hill, and, you know, we're as we're driving there, we're thinking, oh, my gosh, this is three times, and we found nothing. So as we crest the hill, I look to the right, and just as I look to the right, Gail did, too, and she grabs my arm, and we just, like, quick intake of breath, oh, my God, I think we found it.
Yeah, because it was that main section that shows the ant standing in front of the long outcropping, and that was the first thing we saw.
So we drive down, turn, stop in the middle of the highway. Of course, there's nothing in the highway out in the middle, 20 miles out of Palmdale. But so we stop, jump out of the car, and oh my God, here it is, right in front of us. We're jumping up and down, hugging each other. And
there was no fence in front of it.
And there's no fence. We can drive right up there. So first thing we thought of, what are we going to do? We got to call everybody. And cell phones don't work out there.
At least ours didn't.
And so we thought, okay, be professional. Let's go get our pictures. So we drove up, got all our photos, and after about an hour and a half of that, of getting all the photos, we thought, wait a minute, the cell phones don't work, we don't have any water, we haven't eaten since we left the airport, we need to find some provisions here, otherwise they're going to identify us through dental charts out here in the desert someday. And so we finally found a little town, we had something to eat and everything, but it was... And then we had to wait until we got back to our hotel before we could call and tell anybody. It was the most exciting, but also the most frustrating one.
Yeah, we went back the next day and put on our Them T-shirts.
That's great. Well, of course, Them, for the few people who don't know, was a classic 50s science fiction movie about irradiated ants that grew to the size of semi-trucks, and they had built... a mound out in the desert, and our fearless heroes had to go into their anthill and dispatch them. And so so that, you know, that there's certainly tons of desert stuff that shows up, because deserts have to fill in for a variety of alien planets, Mars, the moon, whatever. Also that most of these low-budget films needed to be someplace kind of remote to begin with, because they couldn't afford to have a whole lot of extras, right?
That's right.
Yes, or they had to get away from the unions, which were looking to raise the price of it by, you know, making sure that they had union photographers and all that. Roger Corman was apparently famous for that, trying to duck some of the union rules about filming. And so, yeah, they would find the most obscure places and shoot quickly before too many people found out about it, and then sell it to a distributor, and then plow the money back in, make another movie. That seems to be the life of the low-budget filmmaker, probably even now, I would think, although now they release it on the net or... you know, on video or whatever.
Yeah, we're really lucky in Southern California, because they have all these interesting places out there, like Vasquez Rocks and Red Rock Canyon and the Lovejoy Buttes and stuff like that. They make really good otherworldly places.
So Gail and Ray Orwig are on the phone with us tonight on Thoughtline, and this is 89.7 on your FM dial and kfjc.org on the internet. Where Monsters Walked, California locations of science fiction, fantasy, and horror films, covering from 1925 to 1965. And McFarland Publishers has put it out, and it's just come out. And so the thing that is really interesting, of course, is that how many places are used and reused and almost become like character actors, where it's like, oh that guy,
and oh that cave,
and so we have to talk about Bronson Canyon and Bronson Caves that have been in so many movies. I almost feel like there's got to be, before you drive into Bronson Canyon, one of those little things that you take a number, you will be able to film, your number will be number 10,
So, yeah, really. It probably was like that back in the 50s because so many of them were filmed there.
So, and actually the first feature film that the Psychotronic Film Festival showed, the Robot Monster, that is done completely in Bronson Canyon and Bronson Cave. So tell us a little bit about the topography and what these caves are like.
Well, it's in the Griffith Park area of Los Angeles, just up off of Hollywood Boulevard, and you almost literally threw a rock to hit it. And it is, you got to do a little hiking. There's a parking lot down below, and then you hike up the hill. Originally, they were a quarry, and from what we've been able to find out, I think that they used some of the rocks that they extracted from the quarry to make the roadbeds for the old red car lines that were in Los Angeles for years. The quarry was originally called Brush Canyon. Abandoned caves were later named Bronson after one of the streets that actually takes you up there. I'm not quite sure Bronson, what the name came from, but anyway. And the caves themselves, if you look at it from the air, it's kind of a little U-shaped canyon where the entrance between two fairly tall geologic features, and the caves themselves were tunneled through the main section of rock that you come upon. There's one main cave that goes from the little dirt trail that you come up straight through to the canyon, and then toward the canyon side, there are two offshoots from that main section. We numbered them in our book just so we could keep them straight.
Yeah, we had an appendix in there called "Know Your Cave."
and so that's now. I got to warn listeners that if you do decide to go up there, be aware these caves are unsupported rocks. So it's kind of like hiker beware. I mean, and over the years, bits of rock have fallen down, and they're not nearly as big as they look in the movies. In the movies, they used to ride stagecoaches through there.
Yeah, and we could not believe how, there's so much rubble and so forth in there, and how, some of the taller actors actually fit in there. It's like some of them are so worn down looking now.
Well, and I think that there's a couple of interesting pictures you have in the book where you can really tell how much erosion has happened and how much whatever you want to call it, silt or rubble has sort of raised the floor level.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, it's just a lot of, and you can be standing in the canyon and hear rocks tumbling down the hill just from expansion, contraction, the heat of the day. You can actually hear and actually see small rocks tumbling down, and like you said, the erosion that's taken place. Also, too, I don't think there was any kind of, save the canyon campaigns when they used to do these early films. And so, if they wanted to knock something out or blow something up, they knocked it down or blew it up. And if you go there, you'll see the remnants of other films. There'll be bolts drilled into rocks and all sorts of things like that, artifacts from films or television or even commercials that were shot there.
Yeah, they continued to be used for decades, and they were in television series, they were in serials. It's pretty amazing.
It is one of those things where it's like a character that shows up all the time in all the different movies.
Yeah, the venerable caves.
Well, another place that has shown up in so many movies, televisions, commercials, whatever, is the Arboretum I was thinking that probably people know it best because there's a house that's in there that was used in Fantasy Island.
That was the boss, the plane house every night when that show was on. It was called the Queen Anne Cottage. It was actually built back in 1885, and was kind of one of the last remnants of something that old in Southern California. But yes, we used to see Hervé Villechaize, right, mm-hmm, standing up in the little tower at the very top, announcing to Ricardo Montalban that the plane was coming. Yes, although they could never land a plane on Baldwin Lake, which was right next to it. It was surrounded by trees and far too shallow in order to do that.
And yeah, they actually had painted it some of the times too. We were lucky when we went for the Zombies of Morikawa shoot that the Queen Anne Cottage actually looked like it did in the movie. It appeared to be like a white and red trim kind of thing.
Or like pinstriping on the house.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
That kind of reminded me of Peppermint.
I was about to call attention to the connection to the Zombie of Morikawa, which was a low-budget Columbia movie that was all about, as it says in the title, zombies. Uh-huh. And so you don't see the whole house, you only see kind of the porch, but
right.
But it's
a little driveway up to it.
It's sort of funny that how these little bits and pieces, and you say yourself that in the book that a lot of times it's so remarkable what movies do at a set or a location to make it so much different looking than it does in real life.
Yes, it does. In fact, it's really funny, just like looking through the lens must be different than seeing it in real life, because we've noticed sometimes, you'd have to walk up a rock and to get a certain angle. It's like, well, gee, it didn't look like this in the movie.
Also, with the movies, it compresses the image a little bit. We noticed that with the Rocket Ship XM shoot we did in Red Rock Canyon, is the background rocks. In the film, it looks like one structure, but you get there and it's actually multi-layered, and so you have to stand at just the right angle to get the alignment of all of the layers in order to reproduce the shot that you want. And that happens a lot of times when you're out at some more remote location, out away from the city. And city ones, too, also present other problems with the camera lens. Let me see, either compresses or extends, and so things tend to look further away, or they look much, much closer than they actually do when you're standing there. And that can throw people off when they're trying to find a location as well.
So that must have been a challenge for you when you're trying to find out, because you're looking at things and you're looking at stills from the film and you're like, is this where we're supposed to be?
Yeah,
here's a good example. This one from Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
Robinson Crusoe on Mars had a shot where Paul Mantee when he discovered crashed a spaceship of Adam West, and he's running across this plane, and it has these kind of spire-like rocks in front of him, and it's a very striking-looking location, and it's quite wide, and so you can see it's a fairly large.
It doesn't look anything like that from the road.
But if you're standing below on the road, it looks totally different. It would be something you'd never guess. And the clue we had was we had a photograph of Byron Haskins' film crew standing above these rocks, and they were not quite the same angle you see in the film. And in the background was a building. And so when we were really stumped trying to find where this was, and so we went to the ranger station. And when we went to the ranger station, we thought, okay, which of these rangers here looks like they've been here longest? And we spotted this one guy, so we went over and asked him if this looked familiar. And I said, at first we thought, well, it looks like this location is in front of Scotty's Castle, which is a very famous building in Death Valley. And he goes, oh, no, that's the back of the Furnace Creek Inn. And we're like,
okay.
Oh, that changes things. And so we thanked him and drove back up the hill, and we thought, okay, well, this is the right angle. So I started climbing up these rocks, and the further I climbed up and looked down into this little open area, I thought, oh my gosh, this is it. And one of the other problems with Death Valley is it's quite windy, and so I'm standing up on top of this hill waving and screaming to Gail, I've got it, this is it, and she's...
I'm afraid he's going to roll down there.
Shrugging her shoulders and thinking, I can't hear a thing you're saying. So I just took the pictures and came back down and showed it to her.
It was even worse when we went to UV Crater.
Oh, yeah, UV Crater is another scene from Robinson Crusoe on Mars, and the winds kind of compressed themselves at that end of Death Valley, and when we got there, we get out of the car, I got out of the car, and Gail started to open her door, and it's directly into the wind, and the wind is actually pushing her door shut. Well, she starts laughing, and once she starts laughing, forget it. She's not going to be able to get the door open. And so I had to go around. I'm literally pulling. The winds must have been 50 miles an hour, probably,
yep.
or even more.
Yeah, we weren't at that site very long.
No, we got out, took a picture, got back in before the car blew over, you know.
Well, it's remarkable that as you say that just moving a little bit one way or another can change how things look. How certain places can be used for a number of different films, and I'm thinking of the Portuguese Cove in Palo Verdes, which is the home of Mrs. Muir from The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, but it was also used to shoot parts of The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes, it stood in, well, part of the background of it anyway, the cliff on the north end of the cove served where the dive point where Richard Carlson comes up and you're kind of introduced to all the characters toward the beginning of the film. And so that was also, you could see it clearly in Ghost of Mrs. Muir. And it's also the location where we witnessed the demise of the Curse of the Faceless Man.
That's right.
All of them facing the exact same sets of cliffs. And so it is fun to see, oh, we know where that is. That was in these films.
Yeah, and even more of them were shot over at Leo Carrillo Beach.
Well, yeah, so tell us, yeah, because Leo Carrillo Beach, I Walk with a Zombie. Even Journey to the Center of the Earth was filmed at Leo Carrillo Beach.
Yeah, Space Children,
Carrillo
Tormented.
Beach. Yeah, Carrillo Beach is sort of the Bronson Canyon of the beaches.
So tell us a little about Leo Carrillo Beach that the sidekick for the Cisco Kid is such an integral part of that beach.
Oh, well, he was actually a member of, what was it, some California board, and having to do with preservation, and so and had served on that as well as throughout his entire acting career, and so they named the beach for him, and so that was kind of cool. But I mean, it's an interesting beach because there are several little kind of coves along the beach itself, and so you can almost literally have three or four different filming teams kind of working out there as they when they're on site over there. It was the State Park Commission, that was where he was a member of the board of the State Park Commission. And so anyway, down there, Journey to the Center of the Earth. Journey to the Center of the Earth it's got a kind of an interesting scene, and this is one of those things about looking for details. Is there's a lobby card part of the advertising that they did for the film, and it shows them all lying on the beach. And great scene. You're figuring, oh, they're in the center of the Earth, and this is the underground ocean. Until you look very carefully in the background, you'll see Lifeguard Tower Number 3 in the background of that particular shot. So there's sometimes things in the real world interfered with filming, and of course, the filmmakers couldn't, you know, knock down the lifeguard tower. I'd kind of doubt if they ever even noticed it was there. It would take, you know, crazed people like us to actually notice something like that. but it's a really interesting site, and it's one that they almost always seem to film at low tide, which the first two times we went there, it was not low tide, and so nothing looked like it was supposed to for us.
We had a bit of a problem.
And I never really considered that where the ocean is in relation to the beach has a lot to do with what it looks like.
Well, it gives them a lot more filming space, and also a lot more of the smaller rocks are visible when the tide is out, and so it gives them a lot more, there's a lot more detail to a scene if they do that. When the tide is in, it's just the cliffs along the edge of the beach, and that's pretty much it. And you, in some of the little inlets, you don't even get very much beach to work with. And so tide being out was probably a tremendous aid to the filmmakers, giving them a lot more space and variety to the shots that they could create.
So we're talking with Ray and Gail Orwig, who have written a new book called Where Monsters Walk. It is a kind of an encyclopedic book of California locations for science fiction films, fantasy, and horror films made between the years of 1925 and 1965. McFarlane Publisher has just put it out, and so you can look for it on the internet or request it at your favorite library. And, you know, I wanted to ask, because if we go back to The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, places that aren't, so to speak, is they actually built a temporary house on the hills above Portuguese Cove for the house that appears as the ghost's house in The Ghost and Mrs. Muir.
They use for the exteriors, I believe the interiors were a soundstage.
Oh, a soundstage, yeah.
But the exteriors, they actually built a facade for this house. Probably, you only see it from one side, so I'm sure that was probably all that they probably built. Anybody that's been to Universal Studios knows, you know, you walk around the back of these buildings and it's 2x4s holding it up. But it's a striking scene because you have, looking to the south, it's a very sweeping, you know, coastline that way, and then to the north you have this very hot, very tall cliff that appears in there, and it's just beautiful. It's a beautiful scene. They pick some great locations for that. You know, they have the one down at Palos Verdes Portuguese Cove, and then they also have several scenes that are shot right down here in Monterey Bay.
That's right. So that's another thing that's interesting, because of course that Portuguese Cove is Palo Verdes, which is near Long Beach and Redondo Beach. But then there are several scenes in The Ghost and Mrs. Muir where they're on the golf course at Pebble Beach.
Yes.
They're actually on sitting where actually I believe it's the fifth tee now sits. Which is why the pictures in our book look just a little bit different. Actually, I think they've actually taken down one of the trees, boo-hoo. That was in, you know, that looked pretty close to the ones that were in the scene of the film, but it was still an active golf course. And, I mean, the course goes back to the teens, you know, 1917, 18, and I guess they waited between shots in order to get the George Sanders and Gene Tierney scene where he's painting and, you know, sitting over the cove there.
And since we're talking about Hollywood backlots, we have to talk about Psycho, because that's a very famous home and motel, and you actually can take the Universal tour and see that in the backlot.
Yeah, the house is always a thing that people look forward to seeing.
And then they have the motel is now, you know, on the hill or down the hill from that, and that is yeah, the cameras really come out. Actually, I'm dating myself saying cameras. The iPhones come out, I guess, taking pictures of that. But it's always super popular, and I believe they actually, from time to time, have had a silhouette or something of Mother popping up in one of the windows of the of the home, which is kind of a cool sort of thing.
And they
were able to find some of the non studio locations for that. There's a car lot in I believe it's in
that's right down the street, right?
Yeah, right. It's just down the road from the studio, and it's been remodeled a little bit, but it's clearly the same one that's where she drops off her old car, and you know, picks up a new car before she, you know, goes to the wrong motel. But yeah, and it was funny. We, you know, normally when you go onto a car lot, you know, you're not 30 seconds on the car lot when a salesperson comes up to you. We're walking all over this lot with our little match-up comparison photos. We usually keep that in a binder when we go location hunting. And not a soul came out. I don't know whether maybe somebody else had been there doing the same thing or whatever, but no one seemed interested in selling us a car that day. They just kind of left us alone to take our photos.
Well, it was Century West BMW, correct?
Yes, correct.
And so maybe you just didn't look like BMW people.
That's very possible, yeah. Yeah, they figured, okay.
Yeah, we can leave them.
We saw the car you drove up in. You're clearly not going to buy a BMW.
Well, one of the things that's interesting is a lot of times you discover places and the people who are the current residents are unaware of the history.
And yeah, that was most of the time.
I'm thinking of a great line that you got from a groundskeeper for a high school that you were able to locate for the Brain Eaters, and you asked.
Oh yeah, the Pomona YMCA.
I think we have the YMCA. Gail, you go ahead and tell those.
Yeah, that was really cool because we knew that the movie was shot in Pomona, and we went into a specific area, and it was like, look at the stairs, look at the handles above the stairs. They look like the ones in the movie. I mean, it's just really obscure, and this was from one side that we saw it. And then we decided to drive around the building because we knew there was a fire escape in the film, too. And lo and behold, on one of the sides, we found the fire escape. And so we're all excited, and we're taking pictures. And there was a groundskeeper out there. And so Ray goes, did you know that there was a movie shot here? And he goes, no, what was it? And Ray said, the Brain Eaters. And he goes, I guess I missed that one.
And then he just walks away, turns his back and walks away. And I thought, oh, just not
too bad. That was really funny. We've had a few things like that happen.
Oh, the I Married a Monster house.
Mm-hmm.
The house from I Married a Monster from Outer Space. We figured out from looking at, and this was the interesting thing, is we had a Laserdisc, for those who remember Laserdisc, DVD, and also a video.
Yeah, you can tell we've been doing this for a while.
Yeah. Of this, and the Laserdisc, when they show one scene from the film, you can see the bottom of a street sign. And so we were able to kind of count the number of letters and figure out kind of what that street sign was. And so we figured out the neighborhood and just drove up into the neighborhood, parked the car, and we figured, okay, let's just walk. You know, we do call it a circle search. You start with a small circle, then a bigger one, and just look at the homes in the area. And as we're getting out of the car, here comes this woman walking down the street, walking her dog. And so I thought, ah, local. Let's show her the picture and see if she knows.
It looks familiar.
Yeah. And so we said, we said, excuse me, ma'am, we're blah, blah, blah. I'll give her our intro. And does this house look familiar to you? She goes, what's it worth to you? And we're like, whoa. And she goes, I'm just kidding. She goes, it's my next door neighbor. I'll go take you over. So she took us over there, introduced us to her, and we're showing her the pictures. And she goes, oh, I wonder what my house looked like with shutters because they had been taken off.
Yeah, most of the time people are really thrilled to know. We ran across one gentleman that actually did know because we were looking for a house that was in the Crawling Hand, and lo and behold, we found it. And it was pouring with rain, and we're standing there holding the umbrellas trying to take pictures, and the gentleman comes out of his house and asks if he can help us, and Ray goes, excuse me, did you know that there was a film shot over using your house? And he goes, yes, Crawling Hand, 1963. He was so nice. He let us stand on his porch while we had one of the rare downpours down in Los Angeles. But, it was a lot of fun.
And we should talk about the Enos house is the house from House on Haunted Hill.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Frank Lloyd Wright design. Decomposing granite, I think, is what he constructed it of. And the unfortunate part about decomposing granite construction is it continues to decompose.
Yeah, it was like stuff that, you know, the house was actually sitting on was part of the big tiles that they used.
Anyway, so it's I'm not sure what the status of it is now. We were able to actually take a tour around the grounds at one point.
Yeah, I think that it might be open again for limited tours.
Ah, okay. As it is really quite a stunning looking place. It's, you know, a block kind of construction. Anybody that has seen the house on Haunted Hill, the Vincent Price version, it's very very stunning looking place, and it's the view from the little porch driveway area just in front of the house is stunning, all over Los Angeles. And it is, and that was all that they actually used in House on Haunted Hill, was to drive up the hill, drive into the grounds of it, and kind of set the mood. And then the rest of it was all done on a back lot. But it is, it's quite an amazing looking place. It's just down the street from the residence where the late Forey Ackerman used to live. He lived up in Hollywood Hills.
Yeah, one of his houses that people mostly remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and also the Enos house was used in The Rocketeer.
Yes, right. Interiors were shot there.
Also, L.A. Confidential.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rocketeer.
Blade Runner, yeah.
Yep.
It's got such a really distinctive otherworldly look to it.
Mm-hmm. It's very different from anything else in the neighborhood and any other house that I can remember ever seeing. It's quite a stunning location.
Well, most people were stunned when they saw Plan 9 from Outer Space. and you were able to find the house that Bela Lugosi comes out of in Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah. Well, that was actually, we were helped out.
Yeah, I think Gary Haspel helped us.
Our friend Gary Haspel was able to find that. I think he asked Harry Thomas, the makeup guy, or somebody from that. And they said, well, he's in the Sylmar area. And so... He had actually done the...
Yeah, it was actually Tor Johnson's house.
it was Tor Johnson. He said it was Tor Johnson's old house, and so that was how the connection was able to make Tor being one of the folks in a lot of Ed Wood's films. And so it hasn't changed much other than the fence they have in the front yard now, but it still looks very much like that and all the bushes they have. Everybody in L.A. grows bushes way higher than they need to, and this is hard to identify some of the locations. But
I know there's a couple of pictures of houses in our book. It's like people are probably going to have a hard time telling that it was actually that house because there's all these shrubberies in front of them.
Trees or whatever. But yeah, it was that was how we came up with that information and found that location. It's kind of nifty. It's a little bit of a beat up neighborhood, but the house is still in nice shape, and so that's
yeah. And then the Pioneer Graveyard over there.
The graveyard that they use in the film is still there. It's closed off. You can't get into the property, but there's a preservation society that's trying to, you know, raise money to get it restored and so forth. And if you look at the hills that are very close to where this location is in Sylmar, and you take a look at scenes from Plan 9. You can actually see that, you know, that was clearly the location where they shot this.
So the book is Where Monsters Walk, California Locations of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films. And the films are between 1925 and 1965. Gail and Ray Orwig are the authors and photographers. And on the phone with us tonight on Thoughtline, this is 89.7 on your FM dial. And we're talking about classic horror movies and probably movies that you've never heard of before. But you can if you've got the book, you can find exactly where those movies that you've never heard of happened.
So they're fun. A lot of them are very fun to watch. They may be low budget, but they're not low on entertainment value.
That's the thing that we found very interesting, because a lot of people have been telling us that, you know, by the synopses, it's like, wow, I want to see that movie. So it's like a nice byproduct.
It is, and there certainly are some fun movies two to talk about, because they share the same house, is The Curse of the Cat People and William Castle's 13 Ghosts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Curse of the Cat People, they show not only the exterior of the house, it is the architect from that was that William? Anyway, so Curse, they also show the neighborhood around there. And so it's a nice little tour as the little girl is walking around where the house is. Unfortunately, that house was demolished back, I think it was like the late 50s or maybe early 60s. And what you see, as best we can determine in 13 Ghosts, is actually a still frame of the house that they put in there.
Yeah, because I think it was taken down before that movie was made.
We're pretty sure that it was taken down before that. But there are so many just amazing old mansions that you see in some of these films. Another one was the mansion that was used in the 1957 Not of This Earth. That entire block now is all apartment buildings. And so all of those old mansions are gone. One we wish we could find, but
have Colossus of New York.
Well, Colossus of New York.
And Attack of the 50-Foot Woman.
And the 50-Foot Woman. If anybody listening to the show on the internet in L.A. knows where 50-Foot Woman is, get a hold of us. We'd love to find out.
Yeah, because we don't know if either of them are still up now.
And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the book, because you do have some pictures of some of the houses, like the house in Homicidal that you couldn't find, and then also I think what's nice is that when you do find a house like the Trent House in L.A. that was used in Nightwalker. You are kind enough to say it's a private residence. Please respect the pair.
I think that they probably cut a few of those out, but I think when we started writing the book, we had that on practically every house. So we really, really, you know, want to stress that with people is, you know, they are private residences.
Did you ever get run off the property with a shotgun or
something? Never. In fact, when whenever there was somebody outside, we would always tell them, you know, what we were doing, so they didn't call me.
Everybody we'd run into in these homes, like the gentleman who owned the Crawling Hand house in the West Adams area of Los Angeles.
Yeah, he was one of the few that actually knew, but, you know, most of the time people were fascinated.
Yeah, they were very... very kind, and either that or they're very understanding of two crazy people, but they were always very nice. We never had anybody that was like, you know, get out of here, I'm going to stick my dog on you or something.
Well, you know, another place that's fun to recognize, it's the Hollywood Recreation Center, which is a gym that's used in both Earth versus the Spider and I Was a Teenage Werewolf.
Yeah, that was a fun... shoot, when we figured out where this was, we drove there, and as soon as we pulled up to the parking area, we could see from the windows on the outside, oh my gosh, we found this. And we walk in, and they were showing a film or something to some
kids. We were lucky because it was during the summer, and they had summer activities going on, so we could actually stand in there and see, yes, it matches.
And there was a young man who came up and asked us, he said, can I help you? And I said, well, we explained what we were doing.
We showed him our picture.
And he just went crazy. He goes, oh, my God, this is wonderful. And he's taking us all around. Wait, look. Here, this drinking fountain. This is in the shop.
Yes,
Michael Landon.
The door is over here still, too.
And so he was having as much fun. He took our little comparison booklet, and he's running around the rec center and looking at all the stuff he's showing, and nobody else seemed to be as interested as he was. But he was having just a ball walking around looking at this and taking our pictures with our camera. Mm-hmm. And just he was the most wonderful fellow there, very enthusiastic. And I thought, you know, if I had kids going to this rec center, I'd want this guy working with them, because he just had a lot of energy and just really seemed to just have a great time over there.
Now, I know,
we've met so many people, and they were so nice when we told them what we were doing, and just really excited about it also.
Now, I know that there are some people who are historians of a different kind. They're the people who are looking at these old movies and looking to see what the world looked like back in the 40s or the 30s. And I know that over at the Niles Silent Film Museum, they've done a lot of work of going through a number of Charlie Chaplin films when he was actually filming right over in Niles. They recently discovered that One of the first movies he made when he was working for SNA was a bar that was downtown San Jose. And the building, believe it or not, at least the building next door to the bar is still there. So
oh, cool.
So there's a little bit of history and trying to see how the world was when it was back then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the thing that's kind of scary for us is that, you know, even when, since we worked on this book for a period of years, things have disappeared since we started working on the book. So it's just, you know, seems to us really important to get get photos of it and so forth.
Well, Robert, you mentioned something really important about the building next to the bar. That's a really great clue that we've used in our searches, is not just the building that you're looking for in a particular scene, but what are the other buildings?
Yeah, like Monster of Piedras Blancas, one of the main buildings was no longer there, but one of the small buildings was still there.
Right, and so you use, you know, all kinds of little details like that. Again, it's just really paying attention to the small details that might give you that clue that, you know, finds that movie location for you. And it's, plus, the other thing is that if you love movies, this is just plain out fun to do.
Well, and also that, you know, that as my dad always says, who likes to watch movies a lot, says, you know, each time you see them, each time you go back to them, you notice a little more.
That's right.
Yeah. Absolutely. You pick out details that maybe you didn't see the first time. And, I had some people at my school asking me one time, well, doesn't, you know, knowing how all the special effects were done or knowing where the film was shot, doesn't that kind of take away the magic? And I
not
said,
at
absolutely
all.
Not. It makes it even more special and even more fun to watch when you know all the things that were put into this to make it something that you love so much.
And speaking of a San Francisco movie like It Came from Beneath the Sea, that the giant octopus that menaces San Francisco and tears apart the ferry building, that was all done with stop motion animation by Ray Harryhausen. But they did actually film at Hunter's Point.
Yes, they did.
Right, they did use the base out there at Hunter's Point. You can see, looking back, you know, towards San Francisco in some of the shots. And can I tell my favorite story about that one?
Absolutely. Please do.
This is great. Gary Haskell, again, one of our dear friends, went to San Francisco with his photograph of the octopus grabbing the ferry building tower. And so he's standing there, and he's waiting for the clock to get to the same position that it is in the film, the shot that he's carrying. And so people are coming, you know, leaving work and walking by and everything. And so while he's standing right in the middle of the sidewalk, and this gentleman comes by and kind of looks over his shoulder and looks at Gary's picture. Well, here's the octopus is ripping down the ferry building tower. And he stops, walks back, and goes, when did that happen? And Gary, without missing a beat, goes, oh, 1955. They fixed it since then. And then just turns back and waits for the clock to get through the shot. And this guy walks off, and he must have looked back a couple, three times like, what? What was that all about? And I that is one of my favorite stories about finding locations for that film.
Well, and also the patience you need to have to get that right shot, to get the hands right where they need to be.
Yeah, if you want that exact shot, yeah, sometimes you just got to camp out and, you know, wait for things to... A lot of that is, we've done that a few times with getting the shadows in the right place.
Yeah, like Robinson Crusoe on Mars. Otherwise, the rock wouldn't look like it would in the picture.
Yeah, it doesn't match at all because the light is so bright in the desert and the shadows so stark that you got to kind of wait till the right time of day to get the picture you want.
So we're almost at the top of the hour, but I wanted to have each of you, Ray and Gail, give your science fiction, fantasy, or horror film that's in the book that probably people haven't seen that you'd recommend that they see.
Ooh, haven't seen.
Oh, I would say Dr. X for me.
Oh, okay.
It's a more one of the more obscure ones, and also had an obscure location too. It's in an area in Laguna Beach called Three Arch Beach, and it's not accessible, so we had to use postcards for that chapter. But that movie is a pre-code horror film, and it's so much fun to watch. I totally recommend that one. It has Lionel Atwill in it, and Arthur Edmund Carew's in it, and it's a lot of fun.
Do you have a film, Ray?
Yeah, I do, actually. Mine goes into the 60s here, and it's one that was one of the more recent editions, and it was United Artists 1965 called The Satan Bug, and it's a germ warfare film. And it was filmed primarily out in the Palm Springs area, although there's a shot of Dodger Stadium. Sorry, Giants fans.